China has an XP problem. The government has a cloud problem. You've got a DEFCON problem. And yes, trolls. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 54, recorded August 12th, 2013. The boys are back in town. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by TechServe. TechServe assists U.S. businesses of all sizes with their technology needs, including Apple, Avid, Adobe, and HP solutions. Visit techserve.com/quiet and receive a complimentary iPad deployment assessment. And by RingCentral. We do everything in the cloud. That's why I love my cloud-based phone system by RingCentral. Zero startup costs, and RingCentral is $20 per month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial and buy one desk phone and get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. And by GoToMeeting with HD Faces by Citrix, the powerfully simple way to meet and collaborate with colleagues and clients from anywhere. You can share the same screen and see each other face-to-face with HD video conferencing, even from an iPad. Sign up for your 30-day free trial today. Visit GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use promo code ENTERPRISE. Welcome to TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire, the Digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. And I am so, so happy this week because I am joined by the entire cast of characters, starting with my good friend, Mr. Brian Chee, coming to us from his, looks like, underground lair, maybe in a volcano, geek in paradise. What's it going to be, Brian? Tell me.
We just cleaned up the lab. It was getting a little unwieldy. So since I was one of the hosts for the Cyber Range project that was run in my absence, we cleaned up, made a lot of space, and a whole bunch of new cyber warriors were taking over my lab and learning how to hack into systems.
Well, hold on to that because I want to talk about that in just a second. But first, I want to welcome back the other part of the Enterprise Trinity, Mr. Curtis Franklin from Enterprise Efficiency. Curtis, thank you very much for coming back. I did see you last week, but now that all three of us are together again with Jason, it just feels like a brand new game. Tell me, how are you today?
Padre, I'm doing well. Down here in the swamp, it's living up to the billing. Hot, humid, it is spider season in North Central Florida, and things are just great.
Just great indeed. Now, it's been a while since we've had a live episode. I've been gone for about 6 weeks. T-Bert's been gone on and off for about 2 months. And Curtis has been the loyal trooper. But I thought maybe we should do a check-in at the end of summer 2013. T-Bert, I want to start with you because I know there's a few interesting developments in your life. You talked about cyber warfare. I know that you've been working with, a few teaching opportunities. You want to catch us up real quick on what the Geek in Paradise is up to?
Well, the Geek in Paradise has parted company with Thin Links, unfortunately. The bottom line is that the research projects that I had were taking up way too much time, and I really wasn't fulfilling what Thin Links wanted out of me. So the high road on this is we parted company. I'm hoping we parted company friends. And it's still a good product. I still think it's got a lot of promise. In addition, I was playing host to the Cyber Range in Honolulu. The concept of a Cyber Range is that it is a, think of like a shooting range for gunnery practice. Well, this is where you can safely practice cyber warfare techniques. We all know that knowing offense is just the other half of the defense. So we had a red team that was attacking a blue team, and we had a black team, which was infrastructure, and then we had a white team, which were the judges. And basically all rules were basically just don't leave anything in a state where it can't be fixed. So basically don't do any permanent damage and don't hurt anyone.
So was it a sort of a capture the flag type exercise where you had to defend your servers and attack other servers?
You betcha.
Ah, yeah. Nice.
They were very heavily using Metasploit, but some of the more experienced team members didn't use Metasploit. They actually just used separate tools. And one of the things that I was trying to teach them are little things about the network and what you can do. And we can talk a little bit about that later. But we even had my R2-D2 wandering around with a webcam just to distract the blue team so that the red team could shoulder surf them.
No way. It really was all kinds of exploits. So it was everything from social engineering to what kind of trick can I pull off while they're distracted?
Yes, from what I understand, there was a one person's girlfriend in a really, really short miniskirt also shoulder surfing.
That's devious. I like this. I like this because it's not just a bunch of geeks playing with computers. You're actually trying to teach them some real world usable skills. I want to come back to that in a second, but over to Curtis, because Curtis, I know that your summer has been no slouch either. Tell us, what have you been up to? What conferences have you attended while we've been away?
Well, the last big one I went to was the E2 conference up in Boston. Fascinating conference, all about collaboration tools, social networking, and how the two are coming together for the enterprise. Learned a lot of great things there. Then I'm rolling into the late summer, getting ready for fall. You know, we've got a lot going on with E2 Radio over Enterprise Efficiency. We have 7 shows set up for the month of August. Got a lot of interesting things happening for the fall. And one of the things that I'm playing with actually is doing more with video. I've traditionally really enjoyed doing audio podcasts, doing radio shows, because after all, I think everyone who's looking at me can tell that the microphone loves my face. But trying to do a little bit more video, expand my repertoire of ways to tell stories about the enterprises and the technology they're using.
Nice. I like that. Well, my story has been really, really simple. For the past 2 months, I have been in and out of the country. I've been setting up for the Pope's visit down in Brazil. That's one side. But I've also been creating a brand spanking new network for our institutions. They want a secure way to, well, let's say, guard their communications against prying eyes. So we've been taking a couple of off-the-shelf solutions and putting together proprietary. It's part VPN, part Uber firewall that hopefully I can tell you about maybe in a month or two. Now, that's our check-in. I want to get straight into the news with our Enterprise Byte. But before we do that, let's take just a moment to thank our first sponsor. Now, here on TWiT, we talk a lot about PCs. We talk about Linux servers. But we don't always talk about Apple. And you know what? That's just not right, because Apple is such a big part of the enterprise, which is why I'm so happy that the TWiT Riot is joined by TechServe. Now, as New York's premier authorized Apple reseller and technology provider, TechServe serves creative professionals at all levels, from individual customers to Fortune 100 companies. TechServe carries a full range of Apple products, from iPhones and iPads to iMacs, MacBooks, iPods, and accessories. TechServe also has a range of partnerships with top vendors to facilitate flexible, efficient, and creative solutions for all of your business needs. TechServe assists businesses of all sizes to deploy Apple, Avid, and Adobe solutions throughout the U.S. Whether you're already committed to iPads or just getting started, from sales to support, process to practice, TechServe can help. Some amazing technology solutions are being deployed on iPads right now. If you've been to the Delta terminals in LaGuardia, Toronto, or Minneapolis, you may have noticed that nearly every seat in the terminal is equipped with an iPad. Travelers can now sit anywhere in the terminal and receive real-time flight updates on the iPad, or use them to order food, play games, browse the internet, and check email while they're waiting. Over 1.5 million visitors used these iPads in Delta's terminals just this past year. The result has been a double-digit increase in food and beverage revenue and the highest customer satisfaction scores in all participating airports. OTG Management is the hospitality company behind Delta's terminals. They've tuned to TechServe to provide, configure, and install the world's largest deployment of iPads, a number that just keeps growing as they add new terminals. And TechServe really was the natural place for them to turn because they sell, support, personalize, configure, and manage massive iPad projects. That's in their DNA. From the Delta terminals to a school with 700 chef instructors to an operation that delivered personally configured iPads to 3,000 cable technicians. TechServe is able to do full lifecycle management for all of your technology needs by providing the devices that you need, getting them up and running, teaching you and your staff how to effectively use them, and maintaining them so that they're working efficiently. TechServe also provides ongoing support so that if your enterprise has a problem, help is never further than a phone call away. So if you're considering adding iPads to your business, why not ensure the project's success with the world's most experienced partner? Here's what I want you to do. If your business is considering integrating iOS technology at your workplace, then contact TechServe today and receive a complimentary iPad deployment assessment. Visit techserve.com/Twyatt, and TechServe will help you assess your current or future iPad needs and give you advice to make it a success. That's techserve.com/Twyatt. And we thank TechServe for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now let's get to it. We've got, an enterprise bite with a big bite, and that is China's XP problem. We've got an article here from Computer World saying that, well, of course, Microsoft has marked April 8th, 2014 as the EOL or end of life date for Windows XP. That means no more patches, service packs, or service. Now, Windows XP is a 12-year-old operating system, so this shouldn't be a surprise. And in the United States, around the world, 37.2% of computers are still running Windows XP. That translates into about 570 million machines, but that number is dropping as those machines die, as people transition over to either Windows 8 or more likely Windows 7. Now, in the United States, approximately 16.4% of PCs are using Windows XP, which is a problem because most of those computers are still in the enterprise. However, in China, approximately 72.1%, so almost three quarters of the country's computers, run Windows XP. Now, those are interesting numbers, but I want to throw this over to you first, Curtis. What's the big deal about so many computers being on Windows XP in China? Why is that a bad thing, and why do you think that's such a high number?
Well, I think the high number comes from several factors, some of which are common to the reason that we still have a lot of XP systems over here. For many applications, XP works just fine. At this point, it's rather stable. It's very well known. Users know.
Okay, Curtis, we'll be right back. Let's go over to you, Chibert. Chibert, you actually deal with a lot of XP machines, don't you? If I remember correctly, your university still has quite a few of them deployed.
Actually, there's in the science community, there's actually still a lot of XP because they're running specialized equipment. Even in things like the physical therapy world, like for instance, the machine that the University of Hawaii physical therapy group uses that measures knee flexibility is still running XP. And you got to also keep in mind that a lot of XP licenses out there are actually for XP embedded. So just about every major gas pump manufacturer uses XP embedded for their gas pumps. That's why once in a blue moon, you're going to see a gas pump with the blue screen of death on,
right?
For very good reasons.
Right.
Now, as far as why is China running 72.1%, those are probably running off maybe three activation codes.
Okay. I get it. So we're talking about piracy. Yes.
So anyway, XP is actually a really good operating system. My personal opinion is Steven Sinofsky over at Microsoft made a really, really, really big mistake with the GUI. The original thing that they said is that during the installation process, you can say you want the desktop, or you want the Metro interface, or you want nothing at all. You just want the command line. And what that gives you is the ability to use a very, very stripped down version of Windows 8 for embedded applications or near embedded applications. And this was supposed to lead us into true embedded and true real-time Windows 8 for the embedded world. And that just never really happened.
Right.
So I think our friends at Microsoft missed the boat on this one.
Right. Now, I'm not actually too worried about Windows XP Embedded. Those systems tend not to be as vulnerable to being owned. And as Untoward in the chat room has mentioned, he would actually work with Windows XP machines if they were contained within a VM, which both of us know there's still a lot of VMs running Windows XP. You need to spin something up really quickly. You don't care if it gets infected because you're going to go ahead and shut it down and bring up the VM fresh again. But in China, as you mentioned, because there is such a big piracy problem, most of those 72.1% of machines running Windows XP are actually running the desktop version of Windows XP. And starting on April 8th, they will not be patched. They will not be serviced. They won't be protected anymore. And if there's that many, Curtis, let me throw this over to you. If that's that big of a target of unpatched machines, could China become the next botnet bounty?
Oh, I think it absolutely could. XP machines are very vulnerable. And a lot of companies have leaned on firewalls outside the machines to protect them. But as we all know, that is at best an imperfect solution. If I were the powers that be in China, I would be very worried about this. And the cynical individual that I am, I suspect that they have vast teams of people working on pirating more modern operating systems as we speak.
So, Chibert, is that the problem? The problem is that they haven't been able to pirate Windows 7 yet, and once they figure out exactly how they can work those activation codes, we'll see that 72.1% switch over to Windows 7?
There's already pirated versions of Windows 8, for God's sakes. The bottom line is that, you know, there's Windows XP is actually pretty easy to modify. It's pretty easy to write for. There's still DOS under the hood. There's still a lot of pieces in there that are just left over from the good old days, bad old days, whichever way you want to look at it. Mm-hmm. But XP has an amazing amount of inertia. And you know, I'm sorry. You know, this might be a little racist, I guess, but my brethren in mainland China, for the most part, don't have the same kind of creativity that the U.S. Programmers have. Maybe, just maybe, if they go and, you know, start learning how to play nice and so forth, maybe, just maybe, people like Microsoft might start doing more technology transfer. Because as a programmer, you have a great amount of support. And Microsoft very much gives you your money's worth if you're a developer.
Right.
But our friends in China just don't seem to want to play that game and play nice in the world market. And when they do, they'll be able to go and write code, hopefully just as well as our folks in Silicon Valley.
I want to back up just a second because I don't want this to sound as if it's just a China problem. The numbers did say that 16.4% of PCs in the United States are still running Windows XP, and a percentage of those are going to be running Windows Embedded or Windows XP inside of a VM. However, even the most optimistic numbers say that by the end of life of Windows XP, the lowest that number could drop to is about 11%. That's still 11% of computers, especially in the enterprise, that are running an outdated operating system. Curtis, why do you think people are reluctant to move over? I mean, Windows 7 was solid. Windows 8, okay, we know all the problems with Windows 8, but what will it take to move that last 10, 11% over in order to make sure that the enterprise at least has a modern OS?
Well, I think that the real issue and the thing that will get the final people to move over is, frankly, retirement and old age. What you have is a lot of application users who learn their application, learn the data entry portions of it, essentially by rote. Those are the people for whom it is amazingly expensive to retrain them on any new facet of software, whether it be the application interface change or the operating system change. Those are the sorts of people for whom a company will set an application in stone and do their darndest not to change it forever. To me, the real problem is not so much that the large enterprises are going to stay on Windows XP. The large enterprises have, by and large, moved to more modern operating systems. The problem is that the people who are hanging on to XP by the skin of their teeth are the smaller companies. Those who might have one or two IT generalists trying desperately to keep things running. And they're really the companies that can least afford the consequences of not changing to a more modern operating system. They're caught in a real bind. They have to spend a lot of money to change or face hugely expensive consequences when the worst case scenario around not changing finally comes crashing down upon them. There are going to be some ugly incidents, and we can just hope that when they happen, friendly people like those who live in the Twiat Riot will be there to help them out.
And there you have it, verification that the Twiat Riot are friendly people. Let's move on to the second Enterprise Byte. This one, actually, I think Chibert may have a few things to say about it. The EFF has launched Trolling Effects. It's a brand new site. Imagine it being a cross between Wikipedia for trolls and a more education-based site. The idea is that it will educate on the harm of patent trolling, and it also gives targets of patent troll threats a database of those threats so that they can actually scroll through them and find examples of a letter that they may have received. Now, remember back to our previous discussion of trolls. Some signs of trolls are, one, that the party purchases patents from a bankrupt firm, two, that the party is trying to enforce patents without intending to manufacture products or provide services that utilize said patents, three, the party sends demand letters, normally the same demand letter, to multiple parties at once, often without changing the wording of the letters. It's a shotgun lawsuit. And four, the patent violation is vague. So where this Trolling Effects website comes in handy is if someone receives a threat, a notice that basically says, we believe you are violating patent so-and-so, so-and-so, you can actually type in that patent into the Trolling Effects website. It will show you all of the user-submitted threats so that you can figure out if, wow, they sent this letter to 15,000 different businesses. I don't have to be worried about this. Or I can listen to look at the forums and figure out how people handled it. Chibert, this sounds like a really, really good grassroots effort to stop patent trolls because it's really counting on the goodwill of people who either support the EFF or who have been targeted by patent trolls to build up a database of these threat letters. What are your thoughts?
I think this is truly a wonderful thing. And the other thing that you didn't mention, it's let's vote with our dollars. If you find people on there, you know, before you go out and buy something, let's go look at that site. Let's go find out if maybe they got that technology by being a patent troll. Mm-hmm. Or maybe they've got other products. You know, I personally think if someone's spamming the crap out of me, I'm never going to buy product from them. Well, if they're a patent troll, I'm never going to buy product from them. Let's vote with our dollars, because if a corporation has some legitimate products, but yet they've resorted to patent trolling, maybe they need to be spanked in the marketplace.
Right.
So that's another thing that we can all do to try and stop patent trolling. Stop buying from the patent trolls.
Well, that works if the patent troll actually makes anything. But I think also the EFF is trying to address these NPEs, the non-practicing entities, companies that have IP that do nothing with them. They've never intended to create product, to do anything but sue or threaten to sue individuals who might actually be creating something interesting. Curtis, let me throw this over to you, because last time we talked about patent trolling, we had a nice little article that talked about the typical cost of defending yourself against a patent troll. They figured out that as of 2004, it would cost you $1 million or more before trial, before you even get to trial, to defend yourself against a patent troll, and $2.5 million for a complete defense, even if you were successful. The implications here for the EFF Trolling Effects website is if you were able to connect to all the people who had received the threat, you don't have to go it alone. If you find out that the same letter was sent out to 1,000 different businesses, you could actually team up with those 1,000 businesses, make it a class action, and defend yourself against the troll, and maybe even get the patent overturned. How does that strike you? I mean, will competitors team up in order to defeat a company, an NPE, that they deem to be a troll?
I think that if there is a reasonable way for them to team up without the Department of Justice coming down and claiming that in doing so they're violating some sort of antitrust clause, then they'll be thrilled to do that. You know, this really gets back to the problem that the root issue here is that our patent system is not capable of dealing with either the type or the volume of patents coming from software. I was listening, interestingly enough, to a piece on the radio within the last 10 days. It was talking about this very issue. They pointed out one particular patent troll who had a patent that they were trying to enforce. But if you looked carefully, if you did a search, you found that during the time that this company was trying to get money from other companies for use of their supposedly patented technology, almost 5,000 patents for similar technology had been granted. That's not the fault of the company that obtained the patent. That's the fault of the patent office. You know, what we really need is systemic reform. Until we can get that, then I think that efforts like the EFFs are good shortstops, are good stopgap maneuvers. And I agree that if we can join forces to swat the trolls, it would be a very good thing indeed.
Beef in the chat room actually has a really good point. He says, so basically it will cost trillions of dollars over a few decades to undo all these useless patents. And he's joking, but that's actually kind of true. I think that's what the EFF is trying to short circuit with this new website, because it is user submitted. So you are voluntarily asked to put in your threat letter. Whenever you receive a threat letter, you should drop over to the EFF, put it in, put in the wording. If it's not there, just to give them that database so that other people can search for it. Now, let's do a really quick recap. I know there's some people in the chat room who are a little bit skeptical on how much patent trolls actually hurt us. The last time we talked about a 2011 report that talked about how it cost $29 billion to protect against NPEs. That's non-practicing entities. Remember, we're not talking about companies like Apple or Microsoft or Motorola who have sued other companies for patent infringement, because those companies actually make things. We're talking about pure NPEs. They don't make anything. They don't sell anything. They only sue people. They only sue companies. Now, that's up from $7 billion in 2005, and we're on track to hit about $50 billion in 2014. And also remember that this study does not talk about the indirect cost. So it's only the litigation. It doesn't talk about lost sales or lost productivity or product cycles that have gone off the rails. This is a tremendous amount of money. And so when Beef says that, yeah, it's going to cost a couple of trillion dollars, it will be expensive, but I don't see another way, because the cost for defending against NPEs is just going to go up. Chibert, I want to leave you with the last word here. We've talked a lot about trolls. I know you are particularly ranty against trolls, but is this a first step? Is this a middle step? What's the next step? Now that we are asking people to get together and defend each other against patent trolls, what do you see being the next big thing? Government intervention, corporate sponsorship? What does the EFF have to drive?
Well, we've got to have some changes in the patent process. Something has to happen. I think our friend in the White House, President Obama, is maybe making a move in the right direction. But the reality is the patent office needs some help. I've made a rant in the past that, you know, maybe, just maybe, we might want to consider doing the same thing that academia does for peer review. Maybe what we ought to do is we ought to have, you know, either lightly compensated like jury duty or uncompensated professionals within the field that will go in and do peer review, and you get picked at random just like a jury pool. The patent office is never going to have enough money to handle the kind of volume. The economy just won't support it. At least that's what it looks like. But it'd be really, really nice if the professionals in the industry could be called upon for doing some of this review. You know, who knows? Maybe I'm an ideologist. Maybe I have my head in the clouds. But it occurs to me the peer review process in academia is pretty decent, and maybe it ought to be peer reviewed in the patent office too.
Speaking of having your head somewhere else, when we come back, we're going to be talking all about DEF CON and some of the interesting hacks that I saw while in Las Vegas for the After Black Hat gathering of interesting people. But before then, I want to take some time to talk about the second sponsor of the Twiat Riot, and that's RingCentral. Now, when Leo built the brick house, he decided that we were going to eat our own dog food. We had been telling people forever that it's time to go into the cloud. It's time to take the promise of the internet to the next level. And so when Russell, our IT guy, came to him and told us that we could have a full-featured phone system without a bulky PBX in the basement, well, it was a no-brainer. We love RingCentral. There are zero startup costs. There's no PBX hardware to install or maintain. And RingCentral allows us to customize all of our call handling. Our producers can get their voicemail and their emails. And we can even get all of our fax messages right on our smartphones. And now they have a new feature. It's called the RingCentral app for Salesforce.com. You can integrate all of your phone calls with your CRM seamlessly. Create new records for contacts and leads. Create real-time notes while you're on a call. It really makes your CRM more productive, and it's easy to use. So here's what I'd like you to do. I want you to try RingCentral. RingCentral offers all-inclusive pricing as low as $20 per month per user. You can start right now with a 30-day risk-free trial, and they have a special offer for my listeners. When you buy one desk phone, you get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. So call this number. Designated for my listeners, 800-543-9980. That's 800-543-9980. One more time so the patent trolls don't get us, 800-543-9980. Or you can go to ringcentral.com and use the promo code TWIT. That's ringcentral.com, promo code TWIT. And we thank RingCentral for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get back to it. I know I promised you a video last week. We had an issue where one of the interviewees asked that I not use him, so I have to re-edit that video. It'll either go in next week's episode or it will go straight up to the Twiat YouTube page. I do apologize for all of those who were salivating. It is a really, really cool bit of content, but, you know, that's how DEF CON goes. We will not show people if they don't want to be on screen. But we do have some news from DEF CON that I want to talk about now that Cheebert is back. The first one is all about one of the researchers at DEF CON doing a panel where he talked about security holes in common Wi-Fi routers. Now, it was Jake Holcomb, I can't pronounce that correctly, a security researcher at Baltimore-based Independent Security Evaluators, or ISE. His research showed that there are several SOHO routers, popular Wi-Fi routers, that are vulnerable to, well, some quite simple attacks. ISE found 68 common vulnerability and exposure, or CVE, attacks that affect a number of routers, including popular ones like the ASUS RT-AC66U, the D-Link DIR-865L, the TrendNet TEW-812DRU, and the Linksys EA6500. So it basically runs the gamut of a lot of these SOHO, higher than personal but less than enterprise-grade routers. Using these CVEs, the researcher was able to show to us in real time attacks that run exploits and can compromise all the traffic that runs through the router. The scenario that he gave us would be, imagine a Starbucks or imagine one of these bakeries that offer free Wi-Fi using one of these SOHO routers, getting compromised and then having the traffic, the unencrypted password and usernames automatically sent to a drop-off site. That is actually a possibility. That's something that he showed us, and it was really, really, really simple. I want to throw this over to you first, Curtis. We've talked about this problem when we talked about BYOD, when we talked about teleworkers, in that it can be the point of entry for an intrusion into an enterprise system when you allow telework. Now that we have an additional thing to worry about, and that is that the routers they might be using to log in from Starbucks could be compromised and compromise their credentials, doesn't this make third-party security even more important? I mean, shouldn't you be demanding that your employees use VPNs anytime they're going to be out and about?
Well, I think certainly you want to demand that your employees use a VPN if they're going to access anything that is remotely confidential. And that could include the enterprise email systems or the enterprise internal instant messenger systems. Those need to be encrypted. I think we get back to a stance on security that we've talked about here at TWiET before. That is the assumption that people are going to be listening in on what you're doing. The assumption that your perimeter is vulnerable. The assumption that there are unexploited, at least unpublicly exploited vulnerabilities in just about every piece of access hardware you're going to go through. The real security comes from making the content that the bad guys are able to listen to meaningless to them. Encrypt, multiply encrypt, and make sure that no one attaches without being encrypted. It's the only way to go.
Right. Cheebert, I can't help but think that somehow it doesn't affect a lot of people like the three of us who are already uber paranoid because, yeah, we're encrypting everything. We always use VPN tunnels. But how much more of this do we have to hear before, I'm going to say, the typical user? Because we're not typical users. In fact, the people listening to the show are most likely not typical users. How long until people realize, look, everything you run through a network, you just have to assume it's been compromised?
Well, I think one of the issues that even enterprise people keep forgetting is that most firewalls are actually only designed to defend your network from the outside. And what I actually did a InfoWorld article, and I'll toss that into the chat room right now. I did an InfoWorld article. We actually ran the attacks from both the outside and the inside, and it was devastating to most of the firewalls that we tested, to the point where some other labs borrowed my testing methodology and ran it. And they there's a few vendors that bought the results. And so a lot of these interesting little firewalls are only really designed to be, defend from the outside. From the inside, they just fold up like tissue paper, which is really, really sad.
Right.
So I think that's one of the things that a lot of these firewall vendors are going to start needing to pay attention to, that attacks don't always just come from the outside. They also come from the inside, especially when someone plugs into a trusted network with an infected device.
Right. Actually, we've got a great point from one of the TWiET, right? Robert Bigelow in the chat room writes, and I want to throw this over to you, Curtis. How long until VPN and secure tunneling encryption becomes standard? You don't even have the option not to run it. It's just baked into, let's say, the next version of Windows or the next Office suite. In order to use the service, you have to be encrypted. Do you think that's ever going to take root, or the inherent trouble in having a secure tunnel is going to keep companies from offering that as a standard?
I think that it's something that Microsoft, for example, if you look at what's going on in its Windows 8 latest versions, if you look at what's going on with the interface between Windows 8 and the current versions of Windows Server, they're moving in that direction as rapidly as they can. Microsoft recognizes that default encryption is the only way to convince the enterprise that especially their remote and mobile users are coming in any way securely. And so I believe we're going to see more and more companies start to bake that in. The logical place to do it is at the OS level, whether it be Microsoft or Apple or Google with their various Android and Chrome operating systems. That's the logical place to do it, but if they don't, I think you're going to start to see lots of MDM systems that require encryption and other mobile gateway systems that just won't let a user in if they're coming in the clear.
Right. Well, let's talk about the next level of this. And that is, as Cheebert mentioned, we're not only being attacked from the outside. So this article about these routers that have been compromised. Yes, that's kind of damaging, and yes, it should be eye-opening, but we also experience attacks from the inside. We've got Rev in the chat room, another member of the Twilight Riot, who brings up a good point, which is IPsec is actually baked into to Windows. It was baked into Windows 7. It's actually baked into Windows 8, but it doesn't mean that we use it. Chibert, when do you think we actually turn on encryption even within our protected areas? You're a big proponent of this idea of zones. You need to have zones within your network so that you can have different types of users using different resources and not have to worry about them crossing over. When do we go to that point where it doesn't matter if you're outside the firewall, inside the firewall, you need to have encryption to get to the resources you want?
You know, I don't know. Everybody in the chat room knows I'm a pretty big fan of SonicWall. And SonicWall actually had two technologies that they rolled out, and the technology just fizzled. One of them was a firewall switch. And basically, it was a 24-port switch, so you could literally have 24 zones if you wanted to. That product unfortunately fizzled because the market just wasn't ready for that. The other one is their wireless offer. Originally, when SonicWall started doing wireless, they actually forced you that if you wanted to get access to certain resources, that you actually had to be running a VPN, which made a heck of a lot of sense, especially back in the days of web. Unfortunately, the market pushed back on that, and SonicWall was actually forced to start making some compromises and bridge the wireless to the LAN, which is a big hunk and giant security hole. So ideally, you want to run your Wi-Fi in a separate zone so that at least if someone does manage to break into the Wi-Fi, you have the ability to apply firewall rules so that anything coming from the Wi-Fi can be looked at before it goes to a trusted zone.
Well, I want to move on to my second favorite hack at DEF CON, and that was done by two researchers, Brent Banglar and Scott Burns, who created an IPv6 relay within an IPv4 network and then used a tool that they just released to easily create in a matter of minutes, not in a matter of hours, a man-in-the-middle attack in that IPv6 relay, therefore being able to do a man-in-the-middle attack in all the IPv4 traffic. Now, this tool uses SLAAC, Slack, which is stateless address auto configuration, which is required on all IPv6 stack implementations. Slack allows hosts to generate their own IPv6 addresses, even if they were supposed to have been pre-assigned. Now, Windows XP is immune because it lacks an IPv6 stack. However, Windows 7 and Windows 8 and basically any other client that includes a dual stack within their kernel can be attacked with this man-in-the-middle attack. The scary thing about this is it's using a technology which is supposedly more secure to defeat the security of an older technology. It's IPv6 on top of IPv4, which is very common in networks. We've all been telling people to dual stack their machines. So, Chibert, let me ask you about this. This revelation that IPv6 has now become an attack vector for IPv4, does this make you want to speed up your deployment, make all your networks pure IPv6, remove all the IPv4 addresses?
It's actually not a new vulnerability. The University of Hawaii, when we started rolling out dual stacks, actually realized that if someone accidentally had their Vista machine and set it up so it would share the internet, it became an IPv6 black hole. And that's actually what this man-in-the-middle attack is based upon. You advertise a service as a default router, and then you can use something like Squid to go and run substitution scripts and be a proxy and be able to look at all the data going by. You can combine that with a lot of really scary scripts and that I'm not going to go into, but the reality is if you do have a V6 default router, at least if someone goes and brings something like this up, you're going to start getting some route errors on your IPv6 router. So at least you have a clue. And then the intrusion prevention systems actually have been looking for this type of vulnerability for years and years. So the reality is it can be fought against. It can be defended against. But yeah, you really need to start at least thinking about how to set up a dual stack network at the very least, so that at least you're aware of IPv6 problems as they come up and hit your IPS.
Right, right. A tool was called Evil Foca, F-O-C-A. Curtis, I want to throw this over to you. Enterprises are just starting to switch over to IPv6. Is this going to have an effect? I mean, I'm sure you're going to be talking about this at Enterprise Efficiency, because this attack, as Tubert mentioned, it's been around for a while, but it used to take hours to set up. Now you can set it up in minutes. In fact, the test run that I did at DEF CON was able to set up a man-in-the-middle attack in about 47 seconds. That's incredible. Do you think this would make executives gun-shy about deploying to IPv6?
I don't think it will make the executives gun-shy about deploying to IPv6. I think what it might well do is make them ask a few more questions about precisely how that conversion to IPv6 is being done. And that's a good thing. As Brian said, this is something that isn't new. It's not a surprise to anyone who has their hand entwined in IPv6's innards, but it is spectacular sounding. And it really is spectacular sounding because it gets to one of the things that we fear the most. The internet and all networking is based at various levels on the notion of trust. There have to be devices, network segments, pieces of what we do where we have trusted partners. And we tend to think of our routers, our gateways, as being those trusted partners. If we reach a point where the trust relationship breaks down there, then it makes it much more difficult to move forward with anything like a bold step. That's why it's critical to make sure that you're using security components that are aware of this, that you talk with your network administrators. Make sure that they're aware of these vulnerabilities so that they can take them into account when they're doing the IPv6 implementation. Is it something to shut down IPv6 moving forward? No. It's just one more thing to be aware of in what is a very complex and rather dangerous world.
A rather dangerous world. I think that's what DEF CON was created for. Now, when we come back, we're going to be all talking about Microsoft creating a new cloud for the government, kinda. But before that, I want to talk about our last sponsor of this episode, and that's GoToMeeting. That's right. They've been our friends for a long, long time, since the first episode. Now, we know that it's close to the end of summer, but we're out there. It's great. The weather's fine. The kids are out of school. So we can't always be in the office. But just because you can't be in the office, that doesn't mean that business has to stop. You just use GoToMeeting with HD Faces by Citrix, the powerfully simple way to meet and collaborate online. You can be away from the office and still stay connected to your coworkers and clients. Share ideas, problem solve, get projects done. Now, with GoToMeeting, it takes just a click to share your screen and work on documents in real time. You can turn on your webcam and make your online meeting an HD video conference with just a single click. And then you can see each other face to face. It's like meeting in person. You get to see the expressions on people's faces, that raised eyebrow, that slight head tilt that tells you to explain more. You can easily launch or join a meeting for wherever you are. Whether you need to use your computer, your smartphone, or your tablet, you can even present from your iPad. How's that for flexibility? Now, you may have noticed that I am particularly excited about GoToMeeting. Well, that's because I use it on an almost daily basis for my work and for my podcasting. You see, I'm not just a spokesman for GoToMeeting. I'm a customer. My work has me meeting with literally hundreds of coworkers and colleagues each month. I used to jump in a plane every time I had a meeting because that was the accepted way of getting face-to-face time. But I switched to GoToMeeting and haven't looked back because, well, it saved me time, it saved me money, and yes, it saved my sanity. Not only did it cut my travel time in half, but it's actually improved the way that I meet with my friends, my colleagues, and my coworkers. I love GoToMeeting. It's easy to use, and with HD Faces, it's just like meeting in person. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to GoToMeeting. I want you to try it free for 30 days. For this special offer, visit GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use the promo code ENTERPRISE. Remember, use the promo code ENTERPRISE. GoToMeeting, meeting is believing. And we thank Citrix for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, let's close it up with a little bit of cloud news. We've got an article here from a friend of the show, Mary Jo Foley, who is talking about how Microsoft is building, we think, a cloud for the government. Now, it's an interesting solution because it will be a modified version of Microsoft's Cloud OS platform. We believe it will be codenamed Fairfax, which happens to be the home of the GSA, the General Services Administration, which, probably not coincidentally, would be responsible for this move. It will be based on Azure, but it runs in private government data centers. So, Chibert, this is a semantics thing. We talked a lot about this at Interop. Cloud became the buzzword. You had to have cloud services. But really what we're talking about is Microsoft setting up a private data center for the government, right?
That is correct. Now, keep in mind, this is not the first cloud set up for the government. There has been a VMware-based mini, well, not so mini cloud, that is in the secure environment being run by the DISA folks. One connected to the CIPRNet, one connected to the NIPRNet. So one is unclassed, one is class. This one is going to be more for the, I believe, the unclassified side of the government, things that would be labeled for government use only, for official use only, FOUO. Anyway, the reality is setting up a private cloud is not that tough anymore. VMware has some bundles that do it fairly nicely, and Microsoft Server 2012 actually can now have Microsoft Azure services for Microsoft Windows Server 2012. How's that for a mouthful? You can actually implement a cloud on a single server if you wanted to. It's not that tough. But yeah, this is something that's been a long time coming. There was, shall we say, many, many conversations when I was chief computer scientist for GSA Office of Information Security about this exact thing. But unfortunately, the technology had not quite caught up with the idea yet. But it is a long time coming. And this conversation that I had was before GSA moved to Fairfax, Virginia.
Right. Curtis, I want to throw this over to you because this is actually an extension of a conversation we had almost a year ago in some of the very early episodes of TWiET when we were talking about the enterprise adoption of cloud, that it would only take a few incidents to really make enterprises gun-shy about moving into the cloud because of the privacy issues, the obvious privacy issues. Now we've got the government essentially saying, look, we know how easy it is to monitor, so we want all of our information secure in a private cloud, basically in a private server farm that we can control. With the government doing this, do you see large enterprises thinking at all that they could still move into any sort of a public or semi-public cloud? Or are we moving back to the days where I need to control my hardware, I need to control my services, I need to control the premise in which all of them live, and I need to control the pipe to that cloud?
I know that there have been a lot of conversations that have taken on a new urgency in the last 4 to 8 weeks about precisely how data gets from one part of an enterprise infrastructure to another. The idea of private clouds, locally hosted data centers rather than shared data centers, virtual server stacks that stay on-premise, and as you put it, leased lines rather than commodity internet in order to get from one place to another. All of these are being looked at in a new light, and I think we're going to see a lot of companies doing much more with them. I was having a conversation with someone just last week, and I said, we go through these cycles on a regular basis, but it seems like this time, more than ever, once again, we have reinvented the mainframe. It's just faster and in a few more physical boxes than it used to be.
Right. Chibert, let me go over to you because I think this begs an interesting question, and that is, if someone were to come to you and say, do I use public cloud services? Do I use semi-public? Do I use private? Do I build my own? Is it now just a matter of resources? Is the best solution always to have your own servers, your own services, your own space that is completely locked down that you have absolute control over if you can afford it, and you only use the public option if you... Well, you can't.
It's not so much one answer. It's many answers. It's what is the appropriate technology? You know, my students, you know, Mr. Fedora, Warren Togami, actually called me and said, you know, he respects my opinion just because I'm always the appropriate technology. And that's what I'm always going to say. There's no one answer. I'm going to give Microsoft some serious kudos here. They have designed into Server 2012 the ability to, say, put some things in your private data center and share it, duplicate it, load balance it with a private cloud, and then delegate also to a public cloud when you have the slash dot from hell that's, you know, you can't possibly handle in your private cloud. The answer isn't one. The answer is all. And it's the answer is set up your business rules. Too many people start driving their decisions with technology. That's not the way to do it. It's what is the business case? What are the business rules? How are you going to do business using this tool that just happens to be a private cloud or a public cloud or a private data center? Use the appropriate tool.
Yeah, I like that. Okay, use the appropriate tool. Curtis, let me throw that over to you. Can we now say, again, that same scenario, someone comes up to you for advice. Can you say, if you have any data that absolutely needs to maintain its security, that cannot be released, that it must be on that closed off server farm, it does not touch the cloud at all, and the only time you would trust the cloud, public, semi-public, whatever it might be, is if you have data that could be released to the entire world?
That is the sort of advice I would give, but that's not new. In general, we've known that that was the case. The question really is not so much the cloud. It's how it gets, the data gets from one point to another. If you have a private cloud or even public cloud services that you are reaching on a leased line connection, then you have to have the same sort of court-ordered release, the same sort of search warrant that would allow the government to get access to your data if it's sitting in your own data center. Let's assume just for the moment that we don't have any companies who are going to go full-bore private army, keep everybody out of our data center sort of scenario. So the issue comes in using commodity internet to get from one point to the other. The place where things get really different, though, is if you are an international company looking at data that's coming from many different countries. There you have to deal with the data storage and privacy requirements of the most paranoid country in that chain. And for many of those, the only legal solution is going to be keeping it on your own premise, because we now know that there's no way that a company can guarantee that they're the only entity that will see data if it ever traverses the public internet.
And I think we have to call it on that note, because that's right, you've done it again. You've used up another hour of your time listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the world. That's according to a poll of 2 out of 3 popes. Now, I do want to give some time to our panel for showing up, for being here, for being part of The Boys Are Back in Town. Chibert, tell me what's going on. What do people need to know about you in the next week or so? What exciting projects do you want to tell the Twiat Riot all about?
I'm going to be setting up and showing off a new offering. Well, it's actually not too new, from VMware. It is a bundle. It makes it a lot cheaper and a lot easier for you to go and spin up a baby cloud in your organization. And they've joined forces with HP so that it's a turnkey system. No longer will you have to go and fuss around with, oh, is this piece of hardware going to actually run on ESXi? Is this going to run this or run that? It's all a package. It's all pre-certified. And the license actually lights up everything in the package, so you don't have to screw around with a lot of weird licensing. I'm also submitting an article to Curtis. Oh, by the way, it's in your inbox. Holland America had a magnificent classroom on the water. It's on all 16 of their ships, and they help our parents, the older set, become independent, you know, teach them actually how to do that the modification on that digital image so that they aren't as dependent upon their sons and daughters. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful classroom and well-written curriculum.
And I believe this now means that we need to have a TWIET from the deck of a Holland America cruise ship.
Well,
yes?
There's certainly precedence. Our friend Leo Laporte did a Mac Mania or something like that from a Holland America ship. So let's do it. I like that idea.
TWIET Riot, let's go on a little boat ride. Curtis, over to you. What's going on in enterprise efficiency? You've always got exciting stuff on your site. You've got a roundup coming up, don't you?
We've got a lot of interesting stuff coming on, and actually I've got something this week that bears on the last story we were talking about here. On Thursday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, I'm going to have Gib Sorby, who is the Chief Cybersecurity Technologist for SAIC. Now, if you don't know SAIC, they're the government's pet think tank. He's going to be my guest on E2 Radio. I'd love to have the TWIET right there to listen to what Gib's going to be saying about cybersecurity technology. He talks it in a really big way. Aside from that, lots of E2 Radio, lots of shows coming up. And I wanted to say just real briefly, I've had a chance this summer to meet several members of the TWIET Riot. I've really enjoyed that. Met some folks face-to-face. Had one member of the Riot who helped me out with a problem up in Boston when I left my power cord at home. She managed to help out. We really appreciate that. Met another in Orlando for a cup of coffee. Really enjoy meeting folks face-to-face. Looking forward to doing a lot more of that in the future.
Yes. And you know what? I think this goes for all three of us. If you ever see us, come say hi, because we're thrilled to meet the TWIET Riot. We love you guys. We thank you for watching. And, well, you know, you just make it all possible. Now, you know what else makes it all possible? The subscriptions. That's right. Those people who decide that they can't do without TWIET and they want each and every single episode of the Uber Geek goodness delivered to their device of choice. If you go to our show page at twit.tv/TWIET, you'll find all the different ways that you can get our show downloaded onto your device automatically each and every single week. You want it on your iPad? Of course, we've got an option for that. Your iPhone? Yeah. Your Android phone, tablet? Duh. Hey, even if you want it on your Zombie Zune, we'll do it because we love you. Also, why not visit our TWIET YouTube page at youtube.com/TWIET. There you'll be able to find not only all of the different episodes of TWIET, but also those segments that you love so much. Stuff My IT Guy Says, The Data Closet, Pro Gear, Pro Tip. We put it all up so that you can find the information that you want exactly when you need it. Also, follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/PadreSJ. If you follow me, you'll be able to find out what we're going to be doing each week. And not only that, you'll be able to suggest topics for future shows or tell me, hey, you were wrong, I'm right, and I'll write you back and say, please talk to Chiebert, he's my brain. Also, please, if you're going to follow us, why not follow us live? You see, because this is actually a live show. Right now, I'm alive. I'm reading the chat room, and I'm actually responding to them each and every single Monday at noon Pacific time. We're here in the Twitch studio bringing you the best dang enterprise news that we possibly can. And we've got a chat room. That's right. At irc.twit.tv, you'll be able to meet some of the most interesting people, some of the brightest engineers, and yes, some of the greatest trolls. I'm looking at you, CR1 and Rev. That's right. Come join us and be part of the experiment that is TWIET. Finally, thanks to CyberDog in the chat room and to everyone here at the TWIET Brickhouse Studios for making the show possible. To Karsten, our super producer, and wait a minute. I'm pretty sure we have a technical director who may have a show about Android devices. Jason, what is that thing called again?
Me?
Yeah, you.
Me? Oh, it's called All About Android. twit.tv/AAA records every Tuesday night at 5 p.m. Pacific.
That's right.
Be there.
That's because there should never be a reason for you to turn off the TWIET stream. You should be streaming it 24 hours a day. If you're not streaming it, I really have to question if you've got all your faculties. Speaking of having all your faculties, I'm Father Robert Ballasaire, the Digital Jesuit, and I want to remind you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep TWIET.